This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It is really, really highly transmissible, more than all other variants, including the one in South Africa, Beta.
That's Tulio D. Oliveira, a scientist who sequences viruses on the dangers of the Delta variant of COVID-19. Details coming up. Also, according to the UN, recent attacks in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has been devastating for children. And according to Kenyan officials, at least 350 young people who joined the Al-Shabaab group have surrendered and will be reintegrated into society. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. South African schools are closing again. The bans on booze and indoor restaurant meals are back, and the curfew is tighter. President Cyril Ramaphosa is raising the country's lockdown level after scientists discovered that Delta, the most transmissible variant of COVID-19, is wreaking havoc on the population and overwhelming hospitals. And experts fear the third wave of the coronavirus may be the worst. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
For the next 2 weeks, no alcohol will be sold in South Africa. All citizens are expected to be home between 9 p.m. and 4 a.m. Public gatherings are banned. Schools and tertiary institutions are expected to close by Friday. All leisure travel in and out of the country's most affected province, Gauteng, has been banned. Level 4 is just one notch below level 5, which is the final level and the total shutdown. Ramaphosa says this is the best way to protect citizens.
We are concerned about the rapid spread of this variant. It is much more contagious than measures we have so far adopted to contain the spread of the virus may no longer be sufficient to reduce transmission.
The average number of daily infections has doubled, as have hospital admissions. Deaths from COVID-19 have increased by nearly 50%. The ban on on-site services of restaurants, which were already struggling from earlier restrictions, has sparked anger. Wendy Alberts is the CEO of the Restaurant Association of South Africa.
14 days in our industry is decimation. We are constantly, critically, always put on hold, and we're always the people that are having to take responsibility for the rapid spread of COVID, yet we're still waiting for the scientific evidence and the data to be presented to us to show how and how we are responsible.
Lakin Dimane, president of the National Liquor Traders Council, is also bitter over the blanket ban on alcohol sales.
Almost 250,000 people are not going to go to work tomorrow. The president is going to go to work with his cabinet. That has no clue what is happening on the ground because they live in high chairs. We now have to wake up with a future cut, with poverty a certainty for our people. It is really not fair. We cannot be subjected to this.
However, Elsabe Conradi, CEO at the Emalahleni Private Hospital, says the situation in hospitals is now dire.
Our COVID beds are completely filled up. So even the other hospitals, we try to help one another. You know, when someone has a bed available, we try to accommodate those patients. And the problem is that it's not the mild cases, but it's also a lack of ventilators, ICU beds, high care beds, as well as oxygen.
Nearly 2 million people have tested positive for the coronavirus in South Africa since March last year. Close to 60,000 people have died. The country is struggling to vaccinate its 60 million citizens, with just above 2.6 million people having received their first jab so far. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In related news, scientists in charge of South Africa's response to COVID-19 say the intense third wave of the virus is being driven mostly by the Delta variant, first identified in India. This particular mutation, they say, results in more people being hospitalized. But South Africa's health facilities are already full of patients struggling to survive coronavirus. It's the nation on the continent worst hit by COVID-19, with almost 2 million infections and nearly 60,000 deaths. Darren Taylor has more.
With only a small percentage of people vaccinated, there's a tangible sense of panic in South Africa's health sector.
People who need oxygen and who need admission and ventilation for COVID are being managed at home because there aren't even beds, and that's also in private practice. It's not only in the public setting.
Professor Dania Ballot is clinical head of 4 of the country's biggest public hospitals, all in Johannesburg. She told VOA that healthcare givers are not coming close to coping because of a huge influx of patients. She says their suffering is worsened by regular power and water cuts.
A person who needs admission for COVID sit for 3 days at Helen Joseph on a chair in casualty in oxygen with no water to be able to wash in and waiting for a hospital bed, and there was no ventilator bed if they needed it.
Professor Tulio D'Oliveira is a scientist who sequences viruses. He says several variants are circulating in South Africa, especially Delta, which continues to cause many thousands of deaths around the world. In a Zoom briefing to journalists this weekend, D'Oliveira said Delta's now in about 85 countries and is responsible for 95% of infections in the United Kingdom, for example.
In Africa, it seems to be very widespread also, with many sites in Southern Africa, East Africa, Central Africa, and West Africa. So not only this variant seems to be spreading very fast, but it's very quick to start dominating potentially the global pandemic.
D'Oliveira describes the Delta mutation as by far the most concerning so far.
It is really, really highly transmissible, more than all other variants, including the one in South Africa, Beta. It is calculated that's potentially double more transmissible than the original virus, yeah?
He says there's no evidence yet that Delta's deadlier than other variants, but it causes more fatalities simply because it infects more people. D'Oliveira says Delta also results in more people being reinfected with COVID-19. Infectious diseases specialist Dr. Richard Lessels says there's evidence to suggest that Delta causes different symptoms than other variants.
Certainly in the UK at the moment, the most prominent symptoms are headache, sore throat, runny nose, and sneezing. And what's less prominent are some of the symptoms that we previously highlighted, like loss of taste, loss of smell, fever. These are the kind of symptoms that we should still be looking out for on top of all the normal symptoms of fever, cough, shortness of breath.
But with the rise of Delta in South Africa and elsewhere, says Lessels, there's some good news. The two vaccines being used in the UK, where the variant is particularly prevalent, namely AstraZeneca and Pfizer, are very effective against Delta.
There are very high levels of protection, above 90% protection against hospitalization once you've had the two doses. And even with the first dose, there are very high levels of protection with this Delta variant.
However, South Africa isn't using AstraZeneca since it doesn't work well enough against the Beta variant first found in the country late last year. Pfizer is part of its vaccination program, but stocks extremely limited at the moment. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The UN Children's Fund says recent attacks in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have been devastating for children, many of whom have witnessed brutal acts of violence by armed groups. The organization says the escalating attacks in Ituri province are driving people from their homes. Mavis Ochera has this report.
UNICEF's communication officer based in Goma, Alistair Tancred, says an estimated 5 million people have been displaced in the eastern part of DRC, with over half of these being children. The most recent violence has taken place in the towns of Boga and Tichaba in Ituri province, where almost entire populations have been forced to flee. It's estimated that about 30,000 people have been added to the growing numbers of displaced people. Tancred says many of them currently live with host communities, friends, and families, while those without friends and families reside in camps. He says in Ituri province, there are two big camps with a population of more than 20,000 people.
I think the situation already is dire, to be honest. I think it has been dire for much of the last 30 years, off and on. And that's principally because there are so many armed groups that operate in eastern Congo that it's very, very difficult for the government and the army to exercise any kind of control in rural areas of eastern Congo. Some of these armed groups are fighting for ideological reasons. Some of them, I'm afraid, are little more than bandit groups. But whatever the cause they're fighting for, they do seem to hold sway in vast areas of the east. I'm talking about Ituri, North Kivu, South Kivu. And the government's ability to combat them so far hasn't really succeeded.
Tancred says one interesting development is the government's imposition of a form of martial law in eastern areas of the DRC and the replacement of the civil administration with military officials who are in better position to tackle the various armed groups. An estimated 1.6 million people in Ituri province have been displaced, with more than half of these being children. He says children in eastern DRC continue to grapple with challenges as many have been forced out of school and lack of access to basic social amenities.
I think you can say these children need everything, really. A lot of them don't have access to education. There is some education provided in camps by UNICEF and its partners, but a lot don't. Nutrition is a problem because a lot of these people are existing on only one meal a day, and not particularly nutritious meals at that. Healthcare is a problem, and the risk of waterborne diseases, including cholera and typhoid, is very strong.
Tancred says the UN's operations in the East is seriously underfunded, and that has had a knock-on effect for local non-governmental organizations. He says the culture of impunity among armed groups must be tackled and some semblance of rule of law put in place in the region. UNICEF's priority for the area include working to reunite children separated from their families and recruited into armed groups, along with providing displaced people with access to health care, nutrition, drinking water, and education. Tancred says currently 5.2 million displaced people are in the DRC, more than in any country except Syria. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Oshry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
On Friday, three aid workers from Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, were found dead near their vehicle in Ethiopia's embattled Tigray region. For an update on what's been learned since the grim discovery, International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with reporter John C. Ayana in Addis Ababa.
John Z., what have we learned in the past few days since these three aid workers from Doctors Without Borders were killed?
These three workers were under providing humanitarian aid for Tigray in the area. So they lost the contact with the organizations or the MSF on Thursday afternoon. So on Friday in the morning, their vehicle found empty while their dead body found a few meters away from the car. While expressing their sadness, the MSF said, "No words can truly convey our sadness, shock, and outrage against this horrific attack." So the organization said, they condemn the attack and will be relentless in understanding about what happened to these workers. The Ethiopian government on its side said that frequently they were expressing or telling these humanitarian workers to not to work their own alone without the military personnel. So the area is really under the control or under the active operation of TPLF forces. So the government said the killing was made by an irresponsible group that he called the TPLF group.
So the government is blaming the deaths on the TPLF. Has anyone claimed responsibility for the deaths of these three Doctors Without Borders aid workers, or has the TPLF made any kind of statement following the discovery of the deaths?
As I have reviewed several medias around the region, no one cites the quote or the opinion of those groups, like whether they claim the government did that or they confirm we did so. So I didn't find any facts about this question for this timing.
How are people responding to the news that came out Friday about these deaths?
The situation in Tigray, most recently, especially this week, there is some security problem that the government is also taking some actions to control the problem, and also the all organizations in the world or global organizations like this EU, US, and African Union are just expressing their feeling. The community in Ethiopia, the Ethiopian peoples are also expressing their sadness because the killing is really horrific and heart-touching.
That was reporter John C. Ayana in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa, speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. Leaders of Turkey and France are pledging to ease tensions after months of trading insults, but tensions between them remain over their competing interest in Africa. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian declared Turkey and France are in what he described as a recovery period after the French and Turkish presidents met on the sidelines of the NATO summit earlier this month and pledged to resolve their differences. French President Emmanuel Macron and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan had engaged in a war of words as the two leaders competed for international influence. Sinan Ülgen of the Istanbul-based Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies says there's been a diplomatic breakthrough, but he voices caution.
We can talk about a reset with France, but it's a question about how deep that reset will go. This is actually part of a broader reset that Turkey has been trying in terms of its foreign relations with the West. However, none of the areas of disagreement with France have been resolved.
Libya remains a crucial point of tension. France and Turkey back rival sides in the Libyan civil war, and Paris is at the forefront of an international call for the withdrawal of Turkish troops from the North African country. Last year, Turkish and French warships almost clashed off the shores of Libya over French claims that Turkey was violating a Libyan arms embargo. But Ülgen says both countries now recognize the need for diplomacy.
There's a realization both in Ankara and Paris that some progress can be achieved if the two are less confrontational and work diplomatically towards some sort of a negotiated formula.
A Turkish presidential advisor has suggested France and Turkey could extend cooperation beyond Libya to the rest of Africa to contain China's growing influence. Ankara is building up its presence on the continent, especially in the Sahel region. But Turkish moves to develop ties with former French colonies like Niger and Mali is causing alarm in Paris, says Jalel Hajawi, a senior fellow at the Geneva-based Global Initiative. Hajawi says the Sahel could become an increasing point of tension rather than cooperation.
There's a real rivalry. There's an actual competition in the Sahel because Turkey wants to be present militarily. It is already very present diplomatically, and it's very ambitious commercially. And we're talking about a time horizon of 15 years or 30 years. So if France sees an adversary in that, I think that France is correct because there's not enough room for both former colonizers of the area.
For now, both French and Turkish presidents appear interested in downplaying their differences. But that could change with next year's French presidential elections, where the role of Islam in French society is a campaign issue. Erdogan portrays himself as a defender of global Muslim rights and has in the past accused Macron of Islamophobia, an issue Erdogan also uses for leverage in majority Muslim African countries, much to Paris's unease. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Kenyan authorities say at least 350 young people who joined the Somali Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab have surrendered this year and will be reintegrated into society. Security agencies in Kenya's coast region say fewer youth are crossing to Somalia to fight for the group, in a sign that counter-terrorism measures are working. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Kenyan counter-terrorism officials are in the county of Mombasa this week to help sensitize the community against violent extremism and to assist former Al-Shabaab fighters. Their efforts are targeting six counties directly affected by the terror group's activities along the Kenya-Somalia border. Canon Harun Rashid is the chief officer in charge of preventing violent extremism at the Kenya's National Counter-Terrorism Centre. He says the centre is processing more than 300 former Al-Shabaab fighters who are seeking to re-enter society.
It's not just a blanket returning program, no. All these individuals who are coming in, there is a process of filtering them, understanding the kind of crimes they have committed, and the legal system also is waiting to see prosecutable areas. Once these returnees are put into such a program, then there is the sanitization part of it, the de-radicalization part of it.
For more than a decade, the militant group has used local and historical grievances to get Kenyan young people to join its violent activities. A few thousand Kenyan youths are still fighting alongside Al-Shabaab in Somalia, but increased security operations and awareness campaigns inside Somalia and Kenya's northeast and coastal areas have reduced youth recruitment. Rashid says the counter-terrorism programs now target security officers who are involved in fighting terrorism so they can understand the process of radicalization.
Many of the initiatives cater for the outside, the civilian population. So the new security sector CVE addresses the need of all CVE operators to understand the radical drivers, to understand the legitimacy behind the radicals calling for their agenda. And we've really been equipping them with the knowledge and bringing the awareness to the internal operators or the enforcement.
Nairobi-based security analyst Richard Tuta says Kenyans who join Al-Shabaab can return to Kenya if the government accepts them.
Remember, some of these young people, they did not go there because they were radicalized. They went there because of other factors, like, for instance, to get a source of income. Because one of the ways that it's used to induce them to cross over is because they are promised and even to be paid in dollars. So when the government gives them an amnesty, it makes it easier for them to make a comeback.
Munira Hamisi is the head of Youth Affairs and Community Empowerment in the county of Mombasa. She says her county is ready to provide economic opportunities to more than 100 youths who return from Somalia.
The department, we have the Mombasa County Revolving Fund that has an economic stimulus package for our young people where youth-led business licenses have been waived. We also have the Revolving Fund where we are giving out soft loans to businesses that are owned by young people and women.
The Counter-Terrorism Centre campaign plans to expand and target 12 counties, in all in the hope of encouraging more Kenyan youths to forsake terrorism. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.